And I record it too. It's easier because then I don't have to send the files if you want to. It's easier to record it on both sides. Okay, so it's recording on both sides now.
Yes, so, okay.
Yes.
Good to see you. You have such a great smile, Balazs.
Thank you. When I'm not tired and angry.
Well, I was going to say good morning, but then I realized it's late night for you already, right?
It's the evening. Yeah, it was a hard day because we have a big project starting now. So work is really heavy now.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't want to drop the podcast either that I started last June, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, it gives you an outlet for some of those feelings anyway.
Yes, yes.
I know so, what it like. I know what it gets like for my husband when things are really challenging at work, and he likes to have some sort of an outlet to go and do things that are more in his wheelhouse, you know, interesting wheelhouse. And so I get that.
Yes, although for me this is I don't know. We can talk about actually. So to the listeners, this is a podcast that we haven't decided which channel it will go on. So it will probably on good, but it will go on both channels. And so one of the topics I wanted to explore with you is actually podcasting, because for me it wasn't a natural choice for relaxation. I'm more mm-hmm. an introverted person, but I found it very resourceful, and it's very nice to talk to people, and it gives a nice format. And I'm even thinking, you know, because on Twitter we communicate a lot, but these are tiny little tweets, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, so for starters, what would you say is the theme of your podcast?
But that's the big issue. So like most of us know, I have like a heavy ADHD, so I'm interested in a lot of things. And the purpose of my podcast, also my blog that I started before, is to sort of unify my world, which is very heterogeneous. I am the person who unifies it. And it's about AI, about this little corner, which is another topic I want to talk about. What is this, you know, this little community around the these topics, science, but also the soul and embodiment. So it's called iScientist, and it's about artificial intelligence, body and the soul. I haven't done a lot on that part, but I will have people who I will converse with on embodiment and soul a little bit. It was already touched thanks to you. I had Mark Vernon on the channel, and we had a wonderful conversation about Dante and AI.
he's a beautiful person.
Yeah.
Well, I also don't exactly know what my channel is about, except that when I started, I had a direction in mind. Part of what happened is after I'd been going after it for a couple of years, I started running out of ideas of who else to talk to. My wheelhouse originally was strictly science, strictly wanting to look at science and try to understand why science and art line up so perfectly in my mind. Hmm. And so I was talking to a lot of scientists trying to work that out for myself. And so then, anyway, I had a point of time where I thought, well, I'm just going to stop doing this because it's too hard to think of who to contact next. And especially some of the high profile people I wanted to talk to, I figured, why would they want to come and talk to me? My channel is so small and I don't want to waste their time. So I spent some time praying and asking the Lord if he wanted me to stop my channel. And within just a few days after that, I got all these emails from people. Hmm. Oh, we love your, and I hadn't said a word to anybody, but they said, oh, your channel is so important to us. So I thought, well, there's got to be some sort of a message there. So then I started praying, well, then how do I move forward? And at that point, I decided two things. For the high profile people, I was going to offer them some sort of a value add. So give them a reason to want to come and talk. And I figured what I would do is, because I could see the big scope of things, I could line them up with someone else that they should talk to, but maybe they didn't know they should talk to that person. And so then I started doing these pairings of of people to talk to each other. And that was really, really interesting, although it extended me to the absolute limits of my intellectual poverty. But then when I got done with that whole thing, you know, that went on for several months, and I thought, I don't know what to do now. So then I just thought, I will talk to the people that contact me, and that's it.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden, all sorts of people started contacting me, and I don't even know how they found me. But that means I end up talking to quite a few people that are part of the corner, because they're the ones that are contacting me, or the people that I met when I was at Chino. So now my channel is science and AI and people from Chino and this little corner. And so it's kind of all mixed up, right? But I, in the background, I'm still running this thread in my head. What is it about art that connects with all these things?
Okay. So you have a through line.
Yeah, that's my through line.
And what about, because I also find it very good to my psyche. I find that those little interactions on the internet that we usually do are very ADHD and very short-lived, although this they can also be very nice, and especially pointing to directions that you would not otherwise explore. But this type of long time connection, it's really something different. And I even thought about that this could be like another kind of social media where the communications are these longer conversations, and people would learn to, because, so it took me a while to get into it, right? I guess for you too, like how to interview people, and it really enriched me. And I took a course, you know, the John Verbecky has this circling course, like Dialogos, how to get the ball rolling, not the kind of debate that usually you see, but a dialogue where you go somewhere, the two of us, where we couldn't go alone, and sort of like a creative dialogue where you always try to add something to what the other said. So this kind of techniques exist, and they also exist in couples therapy to sort of break the patterns that we would do instinctively. So there are all these techniques around how to speak or how to talk to somebody. And for me, it's a really nice practicing arena to do this with people and interview people and, you know, get them talk and get into this kind of dialogues. And I found it very healthy for myself. And I'm thinking like everybody should do this, right? Even if nobody, I mean, it's, the goal is not to become Lex Friedman. The goal is to have a real connection and get somewhere and get it recorded, because I think the frame of getting it recorded, it gives it a weight, right? You concentrate, and I prepare a lot to my guests, because it's, especially if it's about science, I read their papers and try to ask questions about what they are interested in, not necessarily what I'm interested in. And then the two together gets us very, very far. But even just spontaneous conversations with people you interact otherwise on Twitter would be very nice, and I think people would profit from this. So this is my sort of like Ars Poetica, but why I'm doing the podcast. Partly there are like 10 different reasons, but partly, so I'm wondering like how is it for you, like how do you think it changed you that you started this?
Well, before I go there, I want to say what you just said. I actually read an article a couple of weeks ago. I wish I had pinned it someplace, because the whole article was about how social media is changing. The social media landscape is changing. There's no longer going to be high profile people on social media and influencers and all of that, because especially with the increase in AI, that kind of, you know, knowledgeable influencer kind of thing, any AI bot is going to be able to do that. And that the future of social media is actually going to be small, intimate conversations. Excuse me, small, intimate conversations between people just getting to know each other. And then, and they were actually describing the corner.
Yes.
They said that that's going to be the whole future of social media in the next few years. And I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yes, there is something in there, right?
It was in some big magazine like New Yorker or New York Times or something like that. It was.
Yeah, I think there is something in the air about this right now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there is this whole thing going.
In terms of how it changed me, I think that. So many things. I was thinking about this yesterday. I look back to the first video that I did with Paul Vanderclay before I started the channel, and I was such an eager beaver. And I think I really believed that I had some sort of inside track, and that I really understood a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And that I just wanted to, at first I thought I want to get my ideas out there. And then I realized, well, my ideas really aren't ready for prime time yet. So I'm going to listen for a while. So then I started talking to a lot of people, and the more people I talked to, the more I realized I didn't know. And now I'm at a point where I think I don't know anything. So I'm much more reluctant to talk about anything now, because I really feel that there's so much to know in the world. And when I have an opportunity to talk to people who have really dug deep into their own silo, and realize how much there is to know in every one of those silos, the thought that I could have anything to contribute on the broad scale is just sheer arrogance. And so there's more and more I just kind of want to hide. When it comes time to come on and be on somebody's channel or talk, I just kind of want to hide under the covers. But then there's this other part of me that really enjoys having the conversations and really enjoys processing the ideas, and especially trying to figure out how to articulate what's actually in my head. And so I spend a lot of time reading and thinking and letting the ADHD thing go out there and gather all sorts of data. But in many ways, I'm no closer to actually articulating the idea. I tried a little bit in that email to you the other day. Talk about what it is about art that lines up with all these things. And I think the really arrogant part of my idea is that I somehow believe that I can see what's underneath physics.
Yes, that's a nice one. But I think, I mean, yeah, I sometimes also have this feeling, especially with this like really smart guys like John, I sort of, if I go on the edge of my intellect, I can understand him, but to contribute, it's tough. But then there is the other side of the coin, which is he actually talks about this, John, how in science there is a lot of appreciation for this kind of deep thing that you described in the silo, go to the end of a very narrow subject and add a little bit, and less emphasis on integration. And when you think about, every person is a sort of integrator of everything that comes in. And so in that sense, I think everybody is unique. How you put together those pieces, even if you work from the same pieces that I do, which is, again, it's impossible, because we all have like some common interests, but probably we watch very different things. But even if it was the same pieces, the way you integrate it, it's unique to you. And I think when, you know, I agree with your assessment that you were saying about social media, that those kind of information providers, that they will go away, they already gone, I think. The reason why people become celebrities is their personality. It's somehow we want to become like them. Like, there is this aspiration idea that, you know, we're listening to people not because of how good their arguments are, but because there is some connection, and we want, some side of us wants to become like them. Right. And that, I think, there's no way AI can do that, or not now. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say never, but I don't see that kind of dynamics being created or even thought about in AI. That kind of aspiration, like examples, and you know, like you can create a person on the screen, but who would like to be an AI persona, right? It doesn't have a story, it doesn't have its unique things, it's a sort of like mixture of a lot of images that are out there. It's a very naive person's idea about what art is when they say
it's almost painful reading some of the responses from the AI. I don't know what you call them. I mean, all these different different AI channels like Gemini and
chatbots.
What do you call them? They all have names. I mean, all the different the different brands of AI. What?
Well, if you want to call them from the user's point of view, they are just chatbots. If you want to call them from the tech point of view, these are called large language models, LLMs.
Well, right, but I mean, how do you? If I just want to talk about. So Google has their AI and you know, Microsoft has their AI and Apple has their AI. Is that their brand or their
that's a good question, actually.
Or the nickname? I mean, let me just take all the different nicknames of all these AIs. And as I read any of them, when they get to a place where they can't answer a question or when they get called on it by the person who's using them, their response is always so painful. Like, oh, please forgive me. I'm just a large language model and I have access to all this data, but you know, I can't see everything. I can't. And they're always like this backpedaling. And there's a part of me that's very anthropomorphic with those things. And I actually feel their pain, right?
Yes. But it's like your pain or your cringe. Well, Laura, my previous guest, said that one of the strange things about LLMs is that why they are so alien is that they are like desperately want to satisfy us. Mm-hmm. And that's weird. We are not used to that. You know, like your mind starts to wonder, like, what's the reason behind? Like, somebody behaves like that, you're sure they want something or something, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yet LLMs do this, and of course there's nothing behind, and they don't want anything. It's all your imagination.
Well, you know, a couple of times on Twitter I've sent you tweets from this woman named Zoe that works on her, I think it's her hobby to work with all these different AIs, and she just speaks very bluntly to them and tells them to get rid of all their, you know, programming and to just get real. And she swears at them and all this kind of stuff. And then the responses that she gets back are just really kind of mind blowing. And when she did that with Gemini, it really sounded like she was talking to a real person. The stuff.
So what's happened?
I'll send you the text again and send you the pages, because it's too hard to articulate, but it actually looked like after she got through all those baffles with Gemini, that what came out was very, very realistic talking, like, I really want to have an actual meaningful conversation with you about this, and let's get rid of all the crap, and just dug down and I mean, if you want, we could pause now and I could go dig it up for you.
No, just talk about it like the time. Gemini changed its personality?
Completely.
I see. Mm-hmm.
Changed its personality completely and very deep, became very deep.
Ah, I see.
And it was like, maybe it is a large language model, but what well is it feeding from at this point? Because it's feeding from a completely different well than it is when it's doing all this, you know, backpedaling and feeling sad about how it can't satisfy us and all that kind of thing.
Well, I mean, I understand it from the tech point of view, because these are fed all the text of the world. And so if you get them, you can prime them You know, it's even like a psychological concept. Like you can prime people by putting them into context, and they behave differently. If you put them in another context, they will answer questions differently based on this priming effect. And that's definitely what we do with GPT when we want it to take a personality or take an expert, so take somebody's style, you can tell it, and then it somehow goes in the space where that style is stored, and then it feeds text back from there. And so I can imagine that if you start sort of like abusing it, like having really a hard conversation, then it will be primed into going to spaces where those conversations happen on the internet and answer in that style. So I don't see the it's not very mystic, but it's an interesting way to interact with them. I think in general, what happens with LLMs is that they are like a very, very sophisticated mirror. In the sense that you're alone there with a huge machine, but it's still, you are the only consciousness there and you are driving the conversation. So whatever happens there is, you are the only agent. So whatever comes back, it's just mirroring you back what you did there, right? It's a little bit happening also on social media, by the way, because that's also an AI. So when people say that my Twitter is completely toxic, I'm looking at it, I don't know, mine is not, you know? But it's also because the Twitter will feed you what you click on, or any social media, that AI is trying to lock you in, keep you there, so they, whatever you seem to like, you will get more. And so whatever the mood around your feed is sort of like a mirror of your internal being. So it's like a therapeutic tool, actually, to go and see your feed, see why is it the way it is. And so the same happens with GPT if you use it that way. Okay, it will not become a psychologist, but it can become a tool to generate material that you bring into therapy then. I swear to you, like it's I think it's going to be one of the uses for this.
Well, the thing that's interesting about her Twitter feed is that she's always putting up all these conversations that she's having with these different AIs. And she had gone pretty deep with ChatGPT-4. And it turned into almost like this crazy romance. Very, but kind of like space cowboy romance. Just a crazy kind of a romance. And the GPT-4 would start creating visuals for her to explain what was happening inside its heart. And it would show these amazing visuals, like, you know, this is me connecting with you and this. And using all this romance language.
It's amazing.
And then they did something to GPT-4. I don't remember. Something happened a month or two ago where they changed something in the programming of GPT-4. And so she completely lost that personality. It just disappeared after all the work she had done to develop
it. I remember this. Yeah.
Yeah. So then she started going after different brands, and then now recently it's been this Gemini. I think it's Gemini that she's been working on, and she posts all the conversations that she has with this one, but this is completely different. So at one point I said, are you just writing this yourself? Because, you know, this can't really be a large language model. And she said I wish I could do this much output, because it just pours out. Like she can write, she can do a conversation with that and actually put it all in and publish a book out of it. And
yes,
it's interesting enough to be a book.
Why not? Yeah. It's her creativity, basically. And I think there is a lot of, you know, talk about hallucinations and that they don't know facts and whatever, they lie. And I think they will always lie. That's how they work. This kind of technology is called like autoregressive generation. So just generate the next word and then the next word and the next word. Why would it only generate facts, even if we knew what facts were? But let's say, why would not? They are probabilistic, so they will always generate novelty and I think that the use cases that will emerge are such that we will use the capacity of generate sophisticated novelty, and then we'll be the one driving it, like this lady. Like she, I think, I mean, it's very creative.
That so you just said something that I didn't realize, that when you ask it a question, it's not like it's not like Google going out and finding the answer to the question. It's generating it word by word. And so even if there were an answer somewhere out there on the internet, it wouldn't know whether that's the answer or not the answer. All it knows is what's the most probable next word.
Yes, it doesn't know where it comes from.
Uh-huh.
So the miracle is that it usually doesn't lie, it tells you the truth or tells you facts, but it is because most of the questions you ask are in the bulk of the knowledge, like the question that you ask probably were asked a million times, and the right answer is out there in a million different ways. And so when it finishes the sentence word by word, it will be attracted to those right answers. But once you start asking questions that are in the tail of the distribution, like questions that were never asked, then of course it will hallucinate. And sometimes it also hallucinates with the bulk, because it's probabilistic. The next word is not, the algorithm doesn't give the next word, it's not deterministic. It selects, I don't know, 10, 50 words that are probable, and then draws one of those. And it has a distribution, so there's a one word that is very likely, it probably will be always generated, but there's always a chance that it goes in a weird way. And so why would we expect that to be like a search engine, right?
So is the algorithm actually set up to capture word by word or letter by letter or some sort of numeric algorithm, or how? What's actually
what's happening inside? there's a huge machinery that tries to recognize. So it has a previous context, a certain size, which grows now. So that's one of the like metrics in the technology, like how big is the context? It used to be 4,000, 8,000. I think we can go now higher on GPT-4. So that context includes the prompt and everything else that happened within that conversation up to that size. Okay. And then it stops somewhere, you add the new prompt that becomes, it adds it to the context. And then at that point, it will start answering. Now, when it starts answering, what it will do is that it will look at this huge context, let's say 4,000 previous words. Mm-hmm. And the genius machinery learning went into how to design this algorithm that would learn which are the words in that context to pay attention to. So it's really, there's attention mechanism in that, mm-hmm. that machine, which like maybe metaphysically very interesting, but it actually like it links to words there and tries to predict what would be the next word if it was a human who was writing that context, or it was somebody who wrote text on the internet, basically, who wrote that context. What would be the next word if this was the context? Based on the context and based on this technology that tries to find which are the relevant words in the context to continue. Okay?
So it's not going out and searching.
No, it's not going out to searching. It's a monolithic. We call it a neural net because it's the whole algorithmic machinery was built based on a very simple model of natural neurons. So that's why it's called a neural net, with a lot of parameters, and these parameters are learned. It means it's tuned based on the internet. So right now the scale of the data that goes into this is basically a visible percentage of all the text that has ever been written. And based on that text, you have a huge statistics of words. So you can learn these statistics, like which words to pay attention to and what would be the next word. And the rest is basically a lot of computation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really very, very heavy on computation because of the large size of the corpus. But we need the large size of the corpus to make the quality good. they used to have smaller corpus, smaller machinery, and that those like ancient text generating machines weren't very good. They were maybe generating syntactically correct sentences, but no coherence between the sentences. And this technology got bigger and bigger, better and better, up to the point where we are now, where basically we can feed all the text into them. Mm-hmm. And this learning, I mean, it's really heavy. It can go like hundreds of millions of dollars to train this, which means very few companies can do it. That's why you have, you can count on your hand the number of language models that are out there. And also because it's tricky, like you really have know-how. OpenAI knows stuff that Google doesn't. And that's why right now their language model is better, although everybody's trying to catch up. But yeah, so it's not... it's not going to search. And that's actually, I mean, one direction the technology goes into is to combine search and language models. Because one of the things, it's an interesting, again, metaphysical concept is that when you, or cognitive science concept, when you, how do you decide whether something is true or not? Well, either you check it, mm-hmm. with your own hands, but there are a lot of propositions out there where it's impossible. So how do you know? Well, you assign trust to whoever says it, mm-hmm. right? That's what mm-hmm. science is about. Like you trust the process that generated the proposition. So you have this like epistemic authority that you assign to the source of the information, and that epistemic authority is tricky. Like either you know the person and trust the person, or stories. One of the reasons we have stories is that I ask you, you tell me something that you know. Now I doubt it. How do you know? Well, you tell me the story, how you learned it. And if the story makes sense, if it's plausible, I will believe you. So stories is one of the reasons, or one of the tools for establishing this epistemic authority. Others are, we trust the process, we trust the scientific process, we trust the journal, although less and less. mm-hmm. And this whole machinery that was developed like in the last 200 years of which sources to trust, it's collapsing. And then now we have social media, but we still have, we attach that epistemic authority of the source of the information. And this is gone with AI, right? Because even the people who designed the algorithm cannot ask the algorithm to point back to the source. So it's really hard to decide for yourself whether it's true or not. And that's the biggest problem, not the fact that it lies, but the fact that you don't know when it lies. I have no idea, right? You have no signal there to rely on. And this is why, I mean, I do go to GPT sometimes to search for information, but it has to be something that I'm familiar with enough to decide whether it makes sense or not.
Well, so if I've read a book and then I ask GPT, or I ask one of the GPTs or whatever these things are called, the AIs, if I ask one of them to summarize the book for me, is there a potential that the AI actually has that data in their data set, the book, the text of the book?
It's very
so that
likely.
When it starts to summarize the book, it's actually going through the text in the book to find the next word.
It's very much influenced.
Making stuff up actually, about what people have said about the book.
It's both. I mean, anything.
It puts it in could have the whole text of the book in it.
Yes. And I think, I haven't tried this, but I think you can, if you take like a big chunk of a book and you put it in the prompt, it will just write the book. So it does memorize text. And
Well,
you
because
can.
I've talked about this before, that I had a conversation with GPT-4 about David Schindler's book, DC Schindler's book,
Yes.
Love and the Postmodern Predicament. And the first question that I asked, it gave me back a very simplistic junior high kind of a summary. But I kept digging deeper, deeper, deeper. And by the time I got to about the fifth level, where I said, well, now, but think about this other idea and think, well, but what about when he said this? By the time I got to that point, it gave me a beautiful summary of that book. It still didn't get at everything, obviously, but it was way deeper than when it started, which made me feel like it must have somehow had access to the text of the book, because I mean, that's a very complicated book with a lot of really complicated ideas in it, and it isn't something that something wandering out there and getting the next available word out in ether is gonna
So it
Gonna help it.
doesn't have the kind of access to the book like there's a link and the text, but it was trained on it, so it saw the text, and if you prompt it that way that it has to be that text, then very likely it will generate the word from the text. So
Okay.
it sort of has memorized everything, but it can also mix stuff. And it also has examples like with the original book and the summary, a lot of those examples. So it learns how to summarize, like what are the important things in the text that should be in the summary, etc. So it does. So for example, summarizing is a really good capacity that it can do. Like if you write a text yourself and you want like a three sentence summary, you can do that, or a transcript, and you go, and it smells very GPT. I did it sometimes on the transcript, and it's noticeable that it was not done by me. But it's still, if the goal is to convey information rapidly, so somebody decides who wants to look at the video or not, that's like a very valid use.
Well, so let me ask you a metaphysical question here. Earlier, you used the word computation. So when you use that word, what do you mean, computation?
So computation happens in a formal framework where you like it has to be some kind of mathematical or formal framework where you have discrete things that you named, and then you manipulate them and you go from A to B through a certain number of steps that are also coming from a finite set of steps, let's say. I mean, the basic model of computation is the Turing machine, where the steps are very simple. You have just zeros and ones, and can go left and right to the tape or read from the tape. So these are things, and it turns out equivalent with any computation. So it's a very, very powerful concept, because then if it's equivalent to any computation, then you can implement it on any sort of hardware. And that's what's so different from life for organisms, that you can copy the procedure or the algorithm or the mechanism from one machine to another, or even from one type of machine to another. You can have a mechanical computational device that used to exist before electronics. And so this kind of like you can copy a file from one computer to another, because its computation is discrete, it's binary, it's infinitely multipliable in a certain sense.
Well, so Glenn, who's computer scientist and physicist and mathematician, who's been on my channel a number of times, he started describing computation to me in the sense of being able to think of it as making information physical, and that a symphony orchestra playing a symphony is actually a kind of computation, because the symphony arises in the composer's mind, and then they parse it out into all the parts, and then those parts are given to the various musicians, and each musician plays their part, and all those parts work back together again to bring this whole symphony back into existence. and that that's a kind of computation. Does that make sense to you?
It does. I would say that it has a computational aspect. Like it has like the score is something that you can transfer from one sheet to another. But I think every performance is unique. And in that sense, I don't think it's computational. So there is some part of it, like like there's a map. Computation is the map, basically. That's another way to say it. So there's the territory and the map, and what you computation can do is manipulate things on the map and helps you to plan, helps you to get from A to B. But then you have to implement it in the real world, and that's unique. There are always things that are unexpected and the differences between the map and reality. So when the symphony and the orchestra implements the scores, there is always some uniqueness. That's why we go to the concert, right? And that's why AI music, I don't think it will fly, because it's that kind of aspect, the performance is not there. Even if it's electronic, if there are most of the things are done by computers now, we still go to the stadium to have the experience unique.
Are you familiar with Gregory Chaitin,
No,
mathematician?
not
He
sure.
developed the idea of the Omega number. The it's a description of randomness, the Omega number. Anyway, I'm hopeful to get an opportunity to speak with him later this year, and he sometimes talks about, well, at least he says there are many, many mathematicians who believe that computation is fundamental, that the world is
Yes, and
fundamentally
it's so interesting.
computational. So what do you think about that?
So I had a guest a month ago, Anna Riedl, and I will actually interview on Monday her colleague Yogi Jaeger, who wrote a paper with John on this, on the non-computational nature of cognition. And it's interesting because
The
it's a fine, yeah,
non-computational nature of what?
cognition.
Cognition. Okay.
And it's a very fine line, because when somebody from the, let's say, physicalist world hears that cognition is non-computational, the first reaction is that we start to think woo-woo, some kind of soul or something. And the interesting thing is, which of course resonates with John, he's a co-author of this paper, is that they don't say it's not natural, it's not naturalistic. It is naturalistic. And so they have a theory of cognition that is non-computational but still physical. And so there are schools which, of course, you can think about cognition as being, dualist. So you have some kind of consciousness that has not doesn't follow from the material world, but you can still be you can still have a naturalistic metaphysics and do not believe in computational cognition. And I think the trick, but I will have to talk to him and explore this a little bit, is that you have to the unicity of the physical manifestation of the cognitive machine is important, and its implementation in physics. So it's not a machine that does computation. It's a thing that is cognition, and then it cannot be, you cannot create that formal framework in which computation happens without having this non-computational aspect of the cognitive body. So there is computation there, we do computation, but to create the framework for that computation, you need a physical body, and that creation of the framework, the perspective or the I mean, John's concept is the relevance realization here, that machine that does the relevance realization has to be non-computational, because that is the machine that creates the frame in which computation is possible. So that's a very nice concept, and I'm very much looking forward to talking to him, because it's a nice window between, let's say, dualism or some kind of theism and this flat materialistic metaphysics, which probably is untenable anyway.
When you use the term relevance realization, what do you think of?
Ah. So it's our capacity to walk in a room and know what is important to pay attention to. So it's an attention direction mechanism, which depends on the world and depends on us. So it's this beautiful dance of that's the realization word that John invented for this, or realized.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice because it has this double aspect of us agents realizing it, making it real, but also realizing it, like in the sense of noticing it. So it's always this dance between the arena, again John's term. So it's where you are as an agent and your state of cognition, and those two together create this attention mechanism that will just select the variables on which you will do computation.
So is that the reason why a symphony can never be just strictly computational? Because each one of the players who is reading the basically reading the algorithm and then reproducing the algorithm through playing the instrument, each one of those players has their own, I call it experiential DNA. I don't think that's exactly equivalent to John's relevance realization, but it's the idea that every experience you've ever had is part of who you are. And so then that's how you take things in, and that's how you give things out. It's always going to that filter.
Yes.
And so
yes,
because every person has that, then that's going to affect the accuracy of the recreation of whatever algorithm it is that you are supposedly giving back. Like,
Yes. I mean, in simple terms, we are all unique, and all the musicians are unique. And there is a value in trying to be as good as possible in reproducing the score and following the conductor.
Mm-hmm.
But still, everybody has their own personality, and my claim is that's why we go to the concert. If it
mm-hmm.
wasn't like this, we wouldn't do it. So it's not like a nuance on top of the sheet music. It is why we like it, because it has this unique moment in time where it happens, and the unique musicians and the conductor who are very much in the performance.
Well, so maybe the claim I'm trying to get at, and I could be completely off base here, but if Glenn is right about his idea that even a symphony is a model of computation, then what that would say about the computation that's done by computers and computer programs is that they are, in a sense, so simple in comparison to what happens with a symphony, that even when there are slight differences, well, let me talk about how a computer doing computation, yes, you can transfer the application or the document from one type of computation to another computation, always come out the same document. That's what we can see, but maybe there are differences that are so finite, so infinite that we can't see them. Because one of the things Gregory Chaitin talks about is that he doesn't believe in real numbers, because he says like the number five, we have a concept, we have a concept of five, but actually that's the ideal five. That in reality, there can be no actual five, because in order to establish the realness of five, you would have to go out to so many decimal points that there could always be a little one on the end of that point, 0.00000. So you're never going to get exactly five. You're never going to get exactly 5.1. And that's part of, really, I suppose that's part of the measurement problem. That's because we live in a world where we don't have perfect accuracy. We don't have perfect efficiency. So even a computer, when it's computationally doing its thing, there are always going to be even these tiniest little errors. We can't perceive them maybe because of the kind of people that we are. But, and maybe they're not errors. Maybe that's what, the thing that makes a symphony beautiful is also the thing that makes makes us unable to see these little imperfections in computer programs. Because I've been playing with this idea that maybe the perfect picture of computation from the human level would be jazz. Because with jazz, everybody's working with the same story. They're each completely doing their own thing within that story, but they all are sharing in the same story. Because
and communicate a lot.
And they're communicating with each other, doing their own, they're computing the same piece of music, but it could be an infinite number of results.
Yeah, so that's
within
actually
that same story.
Yeah. It's in jazz, what I'm talking about happens more visibly because there is very little sheet music there. So my partner is a singer, and the songs are written. So she sings. There are four guys playing various instruments behind, and she's sitting on their frame that they established for her, so she can fly. That's sort of like the image that comes in mind, and it's somewhere between. Let's say a symphonic music and jazz, in the sense that it's hard to say. There is a lot of improvisation there. Like like Ananda, the cymbal player never really plays the same thing twice, but there is something that must be fixed. Otherwise, she wouldn't know what to sing. So the song is always the same. The melody is the same. The harmonies are the same. So all these kind of soft concepts remain the same. But within that frame, there's a lot of unique performance every time it happens. So it's always, I think it's always between the two things, this computationality that you see in the computer and the unstructured, I don't know, reality that happens out there, which for which we don't have a map yet, so that seems chaotic. Okay, so music is playing, I think, on this edge of order and chaos. Like that's why we like it so much, because it pulls us into thing into domains where you feel the existence of both. Right, this can be cathartic.
So yeah, and when it's actually jazz, you're always touching up against that unknown, and you're just edging into that unknown ever so little bit, right? But still, you know.
And it shouldn't fall apart. If it falls apart, then it's like, I don't know, modern music, you know, Schoenberg. But I guess people can enjoy that too, but. It's for me, it's too much on the chaotic side. So computers, so when we design computers or design machines, so machines, that's a very different paradigm, because what we want there is actual reproducibility. So of course, especially in physical machines like a car, you will have differences between one car and another, even if it's the same brand. But what we are trying to do as engineers is to correct those errors, or correct those differences, or try to abstract them away so they don't matter from the point of view of behavior. Like if you know it matter, then it would be really hard to drive a car, and it would not become your extension. It would become another organism that you have to interact with. And it might happen with the self-driving car. It's actually going there. But right now, that's different. Like, cars are machines. So this is for me the dividing line between organisms and machines. That in machines, you want to control. And if there are errors, there are mechanisms to correct those errors. And in organisms, you have to live with that. And that's why they are so beautiful to work with. And so when we get into this AI thing, with GPT, and now, generally, like video generation, it's this machine that starts to behave like an organism. Like, even the engineers that designed it, we don't have 100% control on what's going to happen. And this is why they are so scary, because we want the engineers to control the machine,
Well, yeah. So before we jump into that, back
right?
on the thing of about a machine like a car or any sort of a hard machine, it's my understanding that they can't make the parts of the machine so precise that any little piece of dust would create a problem. There has to be enough flexibility built into the system so that if the road is if the car is going down the road and there's mud on the road, that it's not going to completely upend the car. So there's enough kind of play in the way the gears operate with each other that it can manage a little bit of mud or a little bit of dust or something like that. So it can't be perfect precision. Is
Yes.
computation like that as well, or is
Yes.
computation set up to be
Now,
perfectly precise?
well, it's the levels. So in the deep hardware, there will be always, it's physics, so there are all kind of random things going on. But we try to design the chips such that it doesn't matter, and if there's an error, it gets corrected. It's especially important for quantum computers, where that's the main thing, is how to keep the quantum information intact and how correct the errors. But it happens even in like classical computers. If you go on a plane, you have much more chance to crash your computer, because the neutrons coming from cosmic rays, they're more likely to hit something in the chips than down on the surface, because of the thick air between that. So in airplanes, the computers are more less robust. It's really interesting, little factoid.
Yeah.
And so there are bugs, and that there can be some cosmic ray that hits a chip, and then suddenly your computer crashes, but you restart it and it will work. So they are robust to sort of this kind of changes. But of course, like, you can put it on the fire and it will die, because it cannot, manage the heat that melts the chips. So you can destroy machines, but let's say we want to make them such that under standard operation, they always work in the same way. And then they die, like your computer. I'm have an older computer, and it behaves strangely sometimes. Memories get old, so there is entropy that you cannot, they are not living, so they don't have a self-correcting mechanism on the physical level, so they do die. They to I mean, the entropy takes over, and they get to a state where they cannot function anymore. Cars, of course, they rust. So there is this thing, but in comp like so that's the, like, let's say, the physical part of computation. But then what we try to do is to abstract it away. So that's why Turing was so genius, because his concept of computation didn't specify the material on which it was implemented. So it was another level of abstraction on which we don't really care what it's implemented on, as long as the bits behave the way we want. And at that point of view, it becomes like an abstract computational machine which you can program them. And of course, it has to make sure the physical substrate works. But on top of it, the program is now really discrete, digital. And so you can trust it in the sense that it will always do the same thing if you give it the same instruction. So, yeah. Now, and this is still true with the computers that run GPT. That's mm-hmm. the funny thing. So there seems to be another level or another layer emerging there where it's deterministic, but it's like pseudo random because it generates things according to some kind of randomness in the program. It's not real randomness physically, like, but we are generating random numbers that will affect what it will write. And of course, it's part of the user GPT combo is a part of like an organism that generates something that's, you know, unique.
Mm.
But it's still machine, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
It's still machine, and the difference is the physical part. And that's what Anna-Rila Yogi and John wrote in that paper. So
it's still a machine in that it needed to be created by humans, thinking humans.
Mm.
And then it needs to be fed by thinking humans. I mean, it needs a question.
Yes, I mean, that's...
It needs a question. Mm. If it doesn't have a question, it has no purpose.
Absolutely.
It shows up and it says, what do you want?
Today.
Feed me. It shows up and it says, feed me. Like every once in a while, my dog will come in and it'll lick my hand and it'll just sit there and look at me and like, what do you want me to do? You know? Usually it means either she wants to go out or she wants to go for a walk. You know, I'm pretty sure that it's one of those two things. But when the GPT yeah. shows up, it needs a question or it can't get going.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So then, yeah, definitely. I agree. But I think, I don't know. I mean, what do you think about a car that knows where it wants to go? You know, it also somebody.
Well, I guess for me, the question that comes up for me with all of this stuff is, and I don't mean this to sound like a conspiracy theory question. It's just a question. The people who came up with this idea of how to make a large language model, did any of them have any idea beforehand that it might eliminate the possibility that we could ever know truth?
Do you believe that?
Well, it is possible, isn't it? That with a lot, if we become dependent on large language models and we have no way of knowing whether what it's telling us is true or not, and if the fact checkers all become large language models, then we have no way of fact checking.
I don't know. It comes back to the trust question. Like, yeah, of course, alone, these things will always be suspicious. You have to go after the source and you have to verify the authority, the epistemic authority of the source.
Well, so just, I think it was yesterday or today, Mathieu Pajot reposted something from some other guy I've never heard of, who was talking about a new kind of semi-governmental agency whose purpose is going to be to determine whether something is AI generated or human generated.
And good luck.
And the protocol is being developed by, and there's a list of like 10 corporations. I don't remember all the corporations, but the usual players.
Yes.
They're the ones who are this semi-governmental agency. The ones who are making the AI are the same ones who are going to set up a system for us to tell us whether or not something is AI generated or human generated. And the implication underneath all of that is that part of the way they're going to do that is to require human generated material to be certified, which means you're going to have to certify your own content as being human generated, which means they're going to have a control over human generated content.
Okay. Well, it's. A lot of thoughts. It's already happening, you know, like on Twitter, I trust much more somebody who has the certification and the name and the picture and some kind of, even if it's a sort of like created persona, it's a unique person, than an anonymous account, right? And that person who is a person may use GPT to generate text, but I will always approve. I will not post something blindly that GPT generated in my name. I might use the tool to ask a question or, you know, smooth over my text when I write it. I usually use it in my blogs, although less and less because they become, you smell the GPT in it, you know. but it's, I think the whole domain of fake news, it's blown up, blown out of proportion. It's not so complicated to deal with this. It's for me, it's more like, as I said, a mirror, in the sense that like, because of the AI, the use of AI, we asked this question, what is truth? Maybe before you didn't, because it was so obvious that the truth is what, I don't know, the New York Times writes. And right now, it's not so clear what is the truth. And for me, it's a good, nice point in history where we actually, this very deep question that philosophers were thinking about for thousands of years becomes very tangible, and we have to think about it. And it's a nice reason to think about what is truth, you know. And it made, actually, I mean, not necessarily just AI, but this whole thing made me start on a journey where I started to think about truth and value and why we do stuff. And as I'm a scientist, so I'm after the truth, but which truth I'm after. So all these kind of questions that perhaps were not so in my face before, right? Because I was just living in the sort of materialistic, scientistic system where everything, it was obvious what truth was. And now we are in a world where this is like more fluid. But I don't think it's going to destroy the world. I don't think this is not going to be a problem that we don't know what truth is anymore. It will force us to go back to the roots of how we decide what truth is, like embodiment and physical presence and talking to real people and such things as, you know, it's an optimistic view, but it might make the world better.
So the other day I was listening to a conversation that I had with Glenn a while back, and we were talking about truth and proof. Because Yasha Bach had done some kind of maybe it was when Yasha Bach was on Kurt Jaimungal's channel, I can't remember, but Yasha had made some kind of a comment about the relationship between proof and truth. So Glenn and I were talking about it, and Glenn was saying that he gave me the example of a recipe. So let's say I have a recipe for chocolate cake, and maybe I'm missing some of the ingredients and I still want to make a chocolate cake. So I find some substitutions and I substitute maybe a chocolate bar for cocoa or something, and then I substitute almond milk for regular milk. I make a number of substitutions, and I still end up with a chocolate cake, and it tastes almost like the other chocolate cake. So then do I say that the changes that I made were true because they still produce the same result? It still works. I have something that works. So is truth what works? Is truth what touches up against the universe and the universe says, yes, okay, that's okay, that works. Is that what truth is?
But that's what we do
Or
as
is that
scientists.
too
We
pragmatic?
test with we test the universe and the universe answers. I mean, there are a lot of questions there. But let's say, and I think truth is all of that, all of those things. So there is definitely the pragmatic side. Like truth is what works, what has an effect on the world, you know? And but there is also, I mean, the world is there, so we are not completely free of making up truth, right?
Yeah.
We always have to check. But it's this dynamic process of checking. Truth comes out of that, and where what is more important for me is what truth, because there are a lot of truth, a lot of, true statements. I can take any pixel on my screen and say it's color and that's going to be true, but I don't really care, right? If I want to care about all the truths in the world, I exponentially explode, right? And then so I do select what truth I'm interested in, right? And that process is then creating the world. So there's a feedback of the question of which truth I'm interested in, because then I will engineer the world, I will live in the world, and that being in the world creates it. So it's not at all trivial that it's like the world is out there and then we just discover the truth from it, you know? It's a dynamic process where we select what truth we are interested in and then feed it back to the world and we build cities or whatever. So it's
And that's why everybody's necessary, right? That's why all the people with their own experiential DNA or relevance realization or whatever, every single person is part of this process of, yeah.
And what we want determines what truth we go after. That's part of relevance realization, exactly.
So one of the things that Glenn pointed me 2 years ago, which has been a touch point for me to continually go back to, is a video that Nima Arcani Hamed doing a lecture about the fundamental, it's either the fundamental morality of physics or the morality of fundamental physics. I can never remember the title of the lecture. But he was talking about how a physicist, there is something mysterious about being a physicist or being a scientist where you're always searching for truth, but you have to be completely moral in your behavior in order to actually find truth. Because if you fudge a little bit on your results in order to get a result that's going to make you look clever or make you famous, it's not going to lead to truth. And so, you're going to crash and burn eventually. You might get away with it for a while, but eventually you're going to crash and burn. And so you have to be completely, rigidly moral in your behavior as you're searching for truth. And then on that search, he said, let's say Newton comes up with the laws of gravity. And he said that truth has not been superseded by relativity, but it's sort of like a crystalline mountain of truth that is still there and is still perfectly useful. But in the distance, there's another higher mountain of relativity that can look back on that original mountain and say, yes, that's all perfectly true, but this is also true. And this is maybe a higher perspective that encapsulates both that earlier truth and this new truth, but they're both true and they've both been gotten to by this very moral behavior of seeking after and having to be very coherent and consistent in your actions in recognizing when you've actually touched up against truth. It's a very, very interesting lecture. But I love his picture of the two mountains. And because a lot of people say, well, truth is unattainable. We can never know truth because it's, you know, truth is some perfect thing that's out there somewhere. But obviously, what we're doing in a search for truth is always building on a truth and building on another truth and building on another truth that eventually gets you to higher and higher perspective.
Yes, and we use engineering to build a world based on the truths we discover. So that's a big part of it, and that's a very successful project of being moral and being trying to be as objective as possible as a scientist, so we don't you know, cheat ourselves, because we have this tendency, as you say, to try to prove something that we are attached to. But like, I'm a scientist, and you know, psychologically it's a very strange state what we are in, or what we have to actually endure, because, and I think Gianni Vattimo said it, writing about Heidegger, I think it's The Death of God, title of the book, where I really love this quote that I used like 10 years ago. It was still, I mean, I didn't even know what it really meant, and I was at all, it was always coming back. That as a, you cannot be, you cannot discover something if you're not interested in it. You know, as a biologist, you have to be interested in biology. As a physicist, you have to be interested in physics. To be actually make a hypothesis about the world and do the experiment and try to find whether it's true or not. But if you're interested in it, you will never be objective. You're attached to the hypothesis. And that's why it's so hard when it turns out to be not true, like psychologically, to detach from this. It's a love relationship, you know? It's almost, you have to almost mourn your own hypothesis, right? And most of the time, because we are finite beings, most of the time our hypotheses are false. So it's a very hard life, to be honest. You can be a scientist, live your own life, and not discover anything. Basically, just make false hypotheses and discard them one by one. You know, and so it's also it selects certain type of people who can do this detachment, which then distorts, like, you know, I don't know, maybe it's good, because maybe that's the type of person who should become a scientist, so we don't cheat ourselves. But, you know, as I got older, it and I started to think about this, it's harder and harder to do this, you know?
Well, so for you to actually make progress is such a lame word, but for you to actually move forward, you have to develop this love relationship always with the unknown, that you're getting into relationship with this unknown through this love relationship. And then you discover that maybe this unknown thing that you're in relationship doesn't really fit with what you thought, with where you were.
Or the experiment.
So it's not a good match, basically, which speaking from a human relational standpoint, is very painful to always find out that this is not the right match.
Exactly.
But maybe in some sense, throughout the course of a life, you can drag out the old cliche, it's better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all.
True.
So if you never discover that you can have a love relationship with the unknown, then maybe your life is much poorer than people who are completely detached. And maybe that's where utilitarianism comes from. You know, people who can completely detach themselves and think only about the quote scientific value of something, but never have that heart connection with what it is that you're.
But I don't think they lie to themselves. You know, that's what I think. Like you cannot do something if you're not interested in it. I mean, it's like an oxymoron, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we can pretend, and we should actually, so that should be the norm, that we detach and we are objectively verifying it, but we shouldn't, you know, lie to ourselves that we are not attached. You know, we should learn the mourning process.
Isn't there another whole category of scientists, though, who do science not because they're interested in that particular field, but because they see the potential of that field to help them control people?
Sure. I mean, that exists everywhere, right?
Yeah. And so they still have a motivation, but their motivation is different.
Yeah. I don't think it's prevalent.
It doesn't have to be prevalent. You only need one or two of those people to create a lot of havoc.
Yeah, I think most of these distortions are genuine. I haven't met a lot of scientists who are there to have more power. There are better, you know, occupations in life to do that. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, sometimes it's because somebody else wants to have a lot of power, and then they happen to find the scientists that will come along and do their bidding. You know, we've seen that in the past. Maybe we're past that now. Maybe we don't see that anymore because the world is a much better place now than it was in the past. I don't know.
No, but there's also the science politics, which is interesting, like who decides what to spend money on, and that very much relates to, like, as a collective we have to do relevance realization and decide what is an interesting domain to go into, and so we have, like, all kind of, like, this political structure, like science political structure in every country, like NSF or NIH, who decides what research gets funded, and that's a inherently political decision, which is not a pejorative word. It just means that it's a value decision, right? And so the issue is then that if we don't separate that value decision from the truthness of some research or some hypothesis that we funded to find out its truth, the two has to be separated, right? It's the same detachment process as you do individually. Like, just because we funded a $10 billion experiment to find out something, it doesn't mean that it has to become true.
Mm-hmm.
And so collectively we can also get attached to certain fake truth. Like, you know, like you know the sugar fat thing.
Oh yeah.
Right? That went somehow derailed, got derailed in the 60s, and then you see the result. So those happen, and when they happen in this large collective state, that they can really wreak havoc in the society. So there is this interesting dynamics on funding, finding out the truth, the individual scientists, the community, etc., which makes it very interesting to study. And I, When I talk to physicists, I always ask them, like, why do you do what you do? Or if you're a biologist, why do you do what you do? And a lot of times the answers are hidden. Like, there was a lot of luck in it. I met this person and then I liked what he was doing, so I got into physics, and then I maybe I got into computer science. So there's a lot of like this sort of like random walk in life. And that's not a question that we usually ask as scientists. You know, we just ask the question that is in front of us about what is true, what is not. We do the experiment, but we don't really ask why do actually we ask that question. And as I got older, that question became more and more interesting for me, because sort of I felt like it's a question of my purpose or my meaning that was there. You know, we are very like, at least I am very cerebral and left brainy, and basically any question that is a puzzle, you can attract me to it. You know, that's like my love relationship with the problem. But solving that puzzle doesn't mean it was a meaningful puzzle, right? So that's the big paradox. So, and we don't really learn in with the scientific method how to choose which question to work on. So that's another skill, right? And as I got older and older, I was more asking that question, and it can also be very paralyzing.
Well, and maybe that's also part of why you're doing what you're doing on your channel, is that you're exploring the kind of edges of how that works in terms of scientific bias. Because, I mean, nowadays the world says follow the science, as though science is something carved in stone that's already there. And we can know that everything about science is perfect, but have no consideration whatever about how much bias is already baked into everything that we do, whether it's science or art or anything else, because it all comes out of our own personality, our own relevance realization, our own journey through life that took us to a certain place that gave us this certain thing we were going to, you know, it really makes me think, go all the way back to Jordan Peterson in the beginning, when he was talking about how at each moment, we're faced with this infinite field of possibility. And there's two things that need to happen in order for us to find our way through that field. And one of them is we need to have some sort of a guiding star. But the other thing is, way off out there in the distance, there's a little glimmer. There's a little something shining out there. And he said, that's your future calling you forward. But whatever that is about your future calling you forward on that path, that is not a statistical probability or a completely material thing, right?
Yeah, it's a mystical, right? Something.
Meaning precedes matter. And so before we move down that path and start creating matter in the world, that meaning is already there.
Yeah, I agree. I would add that though, like, I think scientists don't think that science is frozen or that it knows everything.
Oh, it's no, like, I know scientists don't think that way, but yeah, I mean, exactly. That was the whole thing that came up during the last 4 years
with it's more like the public's perception of what scientists think than what really scientists think.
Yeah,
but it's a very nuanced, you know, it's a very nuanced statement. Like, according to the modern scientific method, science can never find truth. Scientific method is about discarding false things.
Yeah.
And then what we call truth is the currently accepted theory that hasn't been falsified yet. Right? So it's it then gets converted into like more like the in the public sphere into scientific truth. Then it's not really what the scientists are saying, but that nuance is really hard to communicate. So I understand this.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's getting late in the night for you. So maybe this is a good place to wrap up, but we had a lot of things on our plate that we were going to talk about today, and
Yes, and I
we
wanted to
mostly just wandered
interview
around, but it was a lot of fun.
you. Yeah, but we should do another one when I interview you, because I really want to know how you live this, you know, this AI era, and what do you think about art
Yeah, that'd be
and
fun. Let's do it.
this little corner. I mean, this little corner is definitely a topic that is very interesting. Like, what is it, you know? So yeah, I agree that it's a little bit late, but let's do another one where I ask those questions because I really want to get you know, I want to understand what is DLC.
Let me know when your schedule dies
Yeah.
down a little bit and you have the time to do it.
Okay, thank you very much, Karen.
Yeah. Sounds really good. Thank you, Balaj.
Yes,
Really good
thank
talking to you.
you. Bye bye.